Welcome to EB5 Investment Voice, where attorney insights intersects with immigration investments. If you are a foreign investor, domestic fund manager, or enterprising entrepreneur and want to get the most out of the EB5 program, you have come to the right place. I'm Mark Deal, and I'll be your co-host on this journey. I'm joined by your host, Mona Shaw, and other attorneys at Mona Shaw & Associates, as well as immigration leaders from around the world. So let's get into EB5 Investment Voice.
Mona Shaw, how are you doing today?
I'm very well, Mark. I hope you're good.
I am good. And not only that, I realize we have a good topic lined up for today.
We have. This topic really came as a result of lots of requests. We're talking about senior assisted living, or ALFs. Senior assisted livings used to be very popular. They still are popular as EB5 projects. And because there have been issues which have come up, there's lots of questions about it. So rather than me answer, I thought the best thing to do was to get somebody who was not only a professional in this area, but who has successfully had a number of EB5 projects, which are senior assisted livings. So I would like to welcome on the show today, Mark, Joni Williams.
Hey, Joni.
Hey, how you guys doing?
We're doing great. Well, let me go ahead and introduce you to our listeners. Joni Williams is the Chief Financial Officer of Watercrest Senior Living Group. Joan has worked in the senior living industry since 2007, where she brings her financial discipline to cash flow, operating efficiencies, reporting and controls, human resource utilization, and strategic planning. She lives halfway between Orlando and Miami in Vero Beach, Florida, where she enjoys watching pelicans and dolphins whenever her husband, Phil, can get her off the golf course.
That's not fair.
I took some liberties with your bio there, Joni. I hope that's okay.
That sounds like I do more pelican and dolphin watching than running assisted livings, but not true.
Well, how about this? I'll make a deal with you. For the rest of the show, we won't talk about pelicans or dolphins. We'll talk about senior assisted living.
Well, not
all
too
right,
much.
I'll try to keep that promise.
Okay.
Well, thank you. Thank you for the introduction. My partner and I started Watercrest 5 years ago after meeting in the industry. So really, he and I have been in it together for 9 years, but most of our team has been doing this all their lives, and it's a real passion and a calling for them. So we're very excited to have started Watercrest to create wonderful assisted living and memory care communities, starting in Florida, and we're now expanding outside of that as well.
Now, I was going to ask you, Joni, what is the correct term? Is it assisted living, which is an ALF, or is it senior assisted living?
Well, I don't know that there's a correct. I would say that for those of us in the industry, we typically refer to our industry as the senior living industry, but that can encompass a whole lot of things. Most typically, it would be independent living, which is really, you know, apartments with amenities or maybe villas, and then going to assisted living, which is where you are licensed under ACA to provide assistance with activities of daily living, as well as activities, transportation, food service, all of that. And then memory care, which is more specific to Alzheimer's and other dementias, but comes under the assisted living license in most states, but not all states. And it is state-based licensing. And then you can go all the way up to skilled nursing and then acute care, but acute care would not fall under seniors typically. And skilled nursing is really a medical model. And typically when we talk about senior living, we don't think so much about skilled. We really kind of look at independent assisted living and memory care. And then we typically refer to our communities as assisted living communities, or I think you said earlier, Mona, ALFs, ALFs.
That's right. That's right. Well, the interesting thing, Joni, is that I know they're popular EB5 projects, and we'll go into why in a minute. But a lot of the people who come in through EB5 have the kind of culture back home where senior assisted livings just either they don't exist or they only exist for maybe medical purposes. I'm talking about countries like China, like India. The patriarch of the family would always stay at home. They wouldn't be farmed out to any particular home.
That's correct. And there are also very big cultural barriers, I think, to doing that, because those cultures have multi-generational households. And it was expected that, you know, you would have your parents or grandparents move in and you would take care of them. Although it's interesting, a lot of our Chinese investors in our projects have asked us to go over there and consult to them on how to build these kind of communities, because they have an even bigger problem than we do with how to care for their parents and grandparents, especially where they, in China specifically, had the one child rule for so many years that there's now a real problem with not having enough children to take care of the seniors who are all living longer.
Right, right. And then along with that, you have the different types, as you've explained, something which might be more, as you say, an independent living. I have heard recently there are countries which normally would not have had this thing, but they have started to have independent living just because people like to sit to live with their friends and go golfing and do the kind of things that older person would do once they're retired.
Exactly. And also not have to take care of a home and a yard and all the, the same reasons why people downsize when they get older. And that affords them an opportunity to do that. So I agree.
So we've identified three different types: the independent living, the assisted living, as well as memory care. And previously on this podcast, we've talked about regional centers versus direct pooled. Does it make sense for one or both of these models for the various types of senior living centers?
Well, Mark, to answer your question, a lot of senior assisted living projects that we have done have been direct pooled. And there are a handful which are, including Joni's, which are come through a regional center. The main difference is because the ones which are direct pooled, as far as we can see, they can easily create lots of jobs. And they only want about 4 million or 5 million, maybe 100 jobs or 90 jobs, which would be required. And so they don't feel the need to go out and be a regional center.
I would give you my sense of it. I don't want to get overly complicated here, but in most assisted living communities, and our communities are not huge. I mean, we tend to run between, on the low end, 60, 64 units for an all memory care to maybe as high as 128 units for an assisted living and memory care combined. But the reality is that if you do have a regional center and you do have to create 10 jobs for every investor, the operational jobs, the ones that are created once the community is opened, have to actually be full-time employees for 2 years, substantiated with W-2s when the investor applies for their 829 and you have to prove that you've created the jobs. Most assisted living communities, including ours, don't actually, at least for the amount of money we've raised, don't actually create that number of operational full-time jobs. Obviously, we're a 24/7 shop. We have three shifts a day, but there are a lot of people who work in our industry that are not full-time, and you cannot combine two part-time employees into a full-time employee for demonstrating that you've created the jobs. That's correct.
That is correct. And I'll tell you where else it falls down. For any of the listeners who are not sure what I mean by direct pooled is a direct job, a direct W-2 would have to be shown, whereas if the senior assisted living went through a regional center, they could show indirect and induced jobs. But where you can fall down is the overall, if you have to look at the total picture, Joni, and you would agree with me, because, for example, you would do everything to keep unnecessary costs down and to make sure that the project remains viable. And if, for example, you find a cleaning firm which you can contract out to, and that ends up being a lot cheaper than having, say, four individual cleaners coming in on a full-time basis, and it's more efficient as well, then you would rather do that. But if you were a direct pooled, you couldn't do that, because that would be a contractual job you had farmed out, and thereby be an indirect job. And so you would have to hire the people inside. But you could only do that if you were going through a regional center.
That's correct. And I would go, I mean, and I would just say that Watercrest, part of, and I know we'll talk about this more, but part of the way we operate, because we're a manager as well as a developer and an owner, is we don't like to outsource anything, because you give up control of quality sometimes that way. But by our using regional centers, which we've done in all three projects that we've funded at this point with EB5, we actually are creating the jobs during the construction period using the regional center and calculating induced and indirect jobs. Obviously, we're not using direct construction jobs because our buildings don't take 2 years to build. But we are creating a significant number of jobs through the regional center, through the indirect and induced. And in fact, we are reducing the EB-5 investors' risk of that even being an issue, because when they go to file their 829s, we will demonstrate that all of the jobs that we needed were created before we even opened the doors to new residents.
Well, that's very good. I tend to agree with you that it is a lot better and it's a lot cleaner through a regional center. For our audience, perhaps you can share, did you use the EB-5 money as a mezz loan or as part of the amount of money which was used for operational costs?
So we used the EB-5 funds purely as kind of a mezz, but it all went into, all of their funds were used toward the actual construction of the building. So we did not use any of their EB-5 funds for operational stuff or pre-opening or any of that. We combined our development funds. And by the way, we don't take a project to the EB-5 investors until we've already gotten all the entitlements and it's essentially shovel ready. And we funded that internally. Then once we bring in the EB-5 investors, their funds go toward the actual bricks and mortar construction, which is exactly how we want to do that. We don't want to get complicated. It's very clear and straightforward for them to know that here's our construction budget, here's our hard costs, our soft costs, and your funds are going to be funding the hard construction.
Well, that's definitely a good way of doing it, but you're not precluded for using EB-5 money for operational costs if that's needed. But one of the reasons, Joni, that we really had a lot of questions about senior assisted living projects or ALF projects is that some of them have done very well, like yours, and some of them have not done very well. And then back in the end of 2014, early 2015, there was quite a lot of publicity in China over one assisted living home where there were SEC fraud charges. The fraud charges were not there at the very beginning, meaning that these people did not start the project intending to do a fraud, but halfway through, when they realized that this project was going to fail, they ended up doing a lot of fraudulent things like pretending people were there who weren't there, etc. And at the end of the day, it came out that this project failed because of inexperience. They were just not experienced enough to run an ALF. This is what worries a lot of our clients.
Oh, I can imagine. I mean, I think that there's a list of things that, you know, I would recommend, and based on our experience, and we've put that in our business plan and PPM, but there's a number of things that investors should ask and look for if they want to invest in an ALF project. I would say, starting with the fact that developing an ALF has all the same risks as any other real estate venture. So whether it's multifamily or student housing or residential, whatever, you've got all the risk of any real estate development, whether it's entitlement risk, construction risk, interest rate exposure on a construction loan, and all of that. So you take that and then you say, okay, now you add the complexity of an assisted living community. So it is an operationally intensive business. It's licensed. So unlike independent living, which is not licensed, assisted living and memory care, you're required, even when you get your certificate of occupancy, until you get your ACA license, you cannot accept any residents into the building. And so you have a very complex investment. So in the normal due diligence, they should be asking the developer for their track record, how many developments have they completed? Were they on time? Were they on budget? And how many assisted living communities has this developer done successfully? Because it's not the same to develop an assisted living as it is to develop other types of real estate.
Like a hotel.
I actually came into senior out of the hotel business. It is very similar. So you take a hotel, which is very complicated, and then you, on top of that, you have to comply with, in addition to the local building codes, ACA has its own set of codes that you have to make sure you're complying with.
Hey, Joni, what is ACA?
The Agency for Healthcare Administration.
That's a government agency.
Yes. Yeah, so AHCA is the Agency for Healthcare Administration. It is a government agency. There is a national AHCA, but every state has its own local AHCA regulations, office, procedures. They're not always called AHCA. Like in South Carolina, you have to go through DHEC, which is Department of Health and something. I don't even remember the acronym. But the bottom line is assisted livings are licensed under the Agency for Healthcare Administration.
So basically then, if you saw a project where somebody had not got any licensing under AHCA, then that would be a red flag?
Yes, I would say that if you have a developer that has never done an assisted living, then you want to dig in and say, okay, well, who is the developer's operator going to be? And just to, you know, give you a little peek behind the curtain, when I go out or when anyone in our industry goes out to get a construction loan, the construction lenders, the senior housing lenders, the first question they're going to ask any developer is, who's your operator? Because at the end of the day, unlike some other classes of real estate, it's not just about building it and getting your CO, but then you have to get licensed and then you have to fill it. And you're not just filling it like an apartment building where, you know, you might have six people at the most on staff to make sure that the residents in an apartment building get what they need. You have to have all the food service, you have all the programming activities, and you've got all of the clinical side of it. So the key will be that the bank and the EB-5 investors should say, who's your operator? You know, what's their experience? What have they operated before? What's their track record? And those are all appropriate and valid questions to ask.
What I have seen is that a successful ALF, senior assisted living project, really does repay the investors, but it's choosing the successful one.
Correct. And the value creation, you know, obviously it's a big milestone when you get it built and you get your certificate of occupancy, but that's not the value creation. The value creation is in the operations. And not to get too technical, but why there's a lot of attraction, certainly in the United States, in just regular equity investments into assisted living versus other classes of real estate, is your return on cost, your unlevered return on cost, which is basically the total cost of your project or the stabilized net operating income once the community is stabilized, divided by your total cost. In assisted living, those numbers, you know, can be 9.5% to 11.5%.
Yeah, well, that's high.
Which is very high.
Yeah.
And when you exit, if you exit, you know, we tend to be long-term holders, but if you are an institutional investor and you're going to sell it in 5 or 7 years, right now the cap rates that these are trading at can be as low as 5.5% up to, you know, for kind of a Class C, it might go up to, you know, 10%. But the point is that spread between the return on cost and the exit cap is very attractive. And that's where the value creation is, because, and that's where the operator comes in. That's where they drive the net operating income and how quickly they fill it and how well they run it, and how profitable it becomes is really the determination of the ultimate value.
Joni, let me back up a second. We've talked about the return on cost and the exit cap rates for these senior living projects, but I would like to paint a picture on what is the wing-to-wing process from, well, getting your permits to doing construction to getting your CO, your certificate of occupancy, all the way to the end to where the doors open and residents can come in.
Sure. Assuming, you know, we've already got our entitlements and our building permit, which we do typically upfront before we even go out to get investors, whether EB-5 or otherwise, during the construction, the manager, the management company, should be either outfitting a sales trailer on the site or identifying a little retail place nearby where they can set up the sales office, because you want to, one of the keys to a successful assisted living community is to make sure that whatever market you're in, they know about you before you open. I think another thing I would say that we haven't mentioned, but it's critically important, and it's part of the underwriting process that banks and investors should do, is to also see that the market and the site within the market that the developer selected is a good one. Every market is the right market, and not every site is the right site.
Yeah, that was my next question, Joni. How much does location matter? I mean, is it because you're in Florida? Does that make a difference?
every, no matter what state you're in, location, you know, the whole location, 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 that's incredibly important. There's a whole lot of science and data behind that, which I won't go into, but one thing I can just tell you for sure, and we see it all the time in our communities, if you have a good location where people drive by you and it's within their normal course of the day, so they may drive by your community on their way to work, or they may drive by your community on the way to the grocery store, but you're in the community and you're in a place where people will see you frequently, they may not even think about what it is that you are and what you do until all of a sudden their mom or dad or grandmother or grandfather is all of a sudden needing assistance. And they go, oh, what's that place I drive by every day?
Yeah.
And it really matters. The other thing is, when they do move their loved one in, they want you to be convenient to them because they want to stop and see mom or dad, you know? So location is incredibly important. And if you're, and this is our opinion, and there's a lot of debate on this, but our feeling is that if you're not, you know, if you're not visible and you're not kind of in the commuting pattern for your market. And by the way, markets are, we call them micro markets. Your primary market area is usually as little as 3 or 5 miles or maybe a 10 or 15 minute drive time. And that's where you're going to pull most of your residents from.
Okay. So it looks like a market feasibility study is certainly a must, especially at a strategic level, you know, planning, you know, what could the market opportunity be. But you also mentioned that during the build and the construction, there should be that sales office or that sales trailer, something, or maybe a demo unit, something that showcases what's going up and be able to take in sales. Is there any way for a potential investor to kind of see inside? We've talked about strategic, you know, through a market feasibility study, but is there any like tactical level insight that a potential investor could see inside of a senior living center to know that, you know, pre-sales have begun and maybe what the response is?
Absolutely, depending on who they're dealing with. But in our case, we certainly keep our EB5 investors up to speed. We do a monthly construction report, which we share with them. You know, I think one of the other questions to your point is EB5 investors should ask if they're going to have visibility into how things are going and what's going on. We send construction photos every month. We send a construction report showing how we're doing versus budget, both time and money. And, you know, when the sales office opens, we share that information. We share pre-leasing numbers and all of that stuff.
Yeah, this is great marketing. There's been one of the things we try to say to projects all the time is that you must give progress reports. You must be visible. And it's great that you do it without being nagged.
Yeah. Kind of in our DNA, you know, we just kind of feel like when people put money in our projects, they deserve to know what's going on. So
I have a couple of other questions. Where do you get your patients from other than just walk-ins? Because obviously, in this industry, people do die and you know, you have vacancies more faster than other places.
Yep. So we don't call them patients. One big distinction between, say, a skilled nursing and an assisted living is we are a residential model, not a medical model. So the people who move into our communities are called residents and not patients. We don't have doctors on staff. We do have nurses. I just think it's important that people understand that an assisted living community is a residential model. There's some clinical aspects to it, but it is not medical, and there's a very significant limit based on our license as to what we can and can't do for residents. And if they get to the point where they need more care than we can provide, we do have to discharge them to like a skilled nursing or a hospital. So I just wanted to make that point. But we, during the pre-marketing or the pre-opening phase, and for us, we basically start a year before we intend to open. We do a lot of outreach. Our team that we bring in to whatever community we're building a community, you know, a project for, they go out and they meet with the hospitals, they meet with doctors, they meet with churches, they meet with social workers, discharge planners, rehab, skilled nursing, all these kinds of places, because you will get people who are drive-by and, you know, their loved one needs assistance. And so they learned about you through all of our different efforts, but you also get a lot of referrals if you know who to talk to and you do that homework up front and you make them aware of what you're doing. You will get people when they're leaving the hospital, you know, they may be told, you know, your mom or dad can't go home. They need assistance. And we recommend that they go into assisted living. They don't need skilled nursing, but they may be more than what you can take care of. And what they will do is they're not allowed to recommend just one. They have to say, here's a list of, you know, three or four assisted livings. But through our marketing and outreach efforts, we can usually be at the top of that list.
That's interesting. I didn't realize they were not allowed to give just one. I was under the impression that some assisted living homes would be connected with certain hospitals.
Well, it is actually illegal for them to do that. There's, and I can't remember the name of the law, but there's definitely a requirement when they sit down with someone who's leaving the hospital that they say, here's a list of places that are appropriate for your loved one. I would tell you there are some assisted living communities who do bring on and pay for, the operative term being pay for, a medical director, which isn't completely, it's not inappropriate. But in Watercrest's case, we very much like to give our residents and our families as much choice as possible. So rather than really kind of partnering or whatever with one doctor and say, if you come into our community, this is the doctor who has to see you. What we do is we say, look, your mom or dad has been seeing Dr. Smith, you know, for the last 20 years and wants to continue to see Dr. Smith, and Dr. Smith will be able to come in and see your mom in our community. And we think that is a much better model to give them the choice and the ability to continue to see who they've been seeing. Look, at the end of the day, what we're building is we're building a new home for them. It's hard enough when they have to leave their own home and come into an assisted living. The more you can keep life the way they were used to without having to change their doctors and all that stuff, the better, in our opinion.
Right. Well, spoken like a assisted living developer, because we often, when we're looking at projects, Joni, of course, you know that we are just looking at viability. How will the investor get their money back? I mean, I know that these are really good projects if they're done correctly, but they're a lot harder than doing an ordinary hotel.
Absolutely.
Takes a lot more expertise.
It does. And there's a lot more risk. I mean, so the other elements to think about are, because it is a licensed business, and in some cases, and certainly like in Florida, you know, you drive around Florida and you see a lot of billboards for attorneys who want to help you sue somebody for the fact that your mom or dad fell, you know. And here's the thing I would say, that there are always going to be situations, people get old and frail and sometimes they fall. How you manage that risk is a critical part. It's very hard for investors to really do their due diligence on that, but I'll give you a couple of pointers to think about. One is that they can go to every state's ACA website. We'll list the assisted living communities that are licensed, and it will also list any surveys, complaints, et cetera, and fines that they've had. So one thing that they could ask an operator that they're looking at, if they're looking at doing their project, is tell me where you have other locations, or you can go on their website and see it. And then you can go and do your own homework, which, you know, I think people should do. And even the best operators, sometimes things happen. But I think you can see with certain operators a lot fewer of those kinds of instances where they get written up for things not being compliant, or they have more complaint surveys than, say, the average. And so there are ways to kind of go behind the scenes and look at those things.
Well, Joni, thank you so much for coming on EB5 Investment Voice and talking through some of the complexities with senior living centers and the different types and what investors should be looking for. Again, thank you so much. Every day I get a little older and I kind of am looking forward to the day I don't have to cut my own lawn. So independent living is starting to look more attractive every day.
Yeah, well, keep in touch. I'm sure we'll have a place for you.
Great. Right there in sunny Florida. Thank you again for coming on.
Thank you guys for having me.
Thank you for being with us today on EB5 Investment Voice. The topics presented in this podcast is informational in nature and is not to be taken as specific legal advice. If you have questions on the topics presented in this episode or other investment immigration needs, please contact Mona Shaw and Associates. Mona and her attorney staff can be reached at mshawlaw.com.
That's mshahlaw.com. Make sure you don't miss our next episode focusing on a different aspect of the EB-5 program by subscribing to the podcast. While you're at it, leave us a rating on iTunes. If you really found this episode valuable, share it with someone else that could benefit from this information. Until then, I'll see you on the next episode of EB-5 Investment Voice.